The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
Hello, yeah, it's been a while. Not much. How about you? I'm not sure why I called. I guess I really just wanted to talk to you. And I was thinking maybe later on we could get together for a while. It's been such a long time and I really do miss your smile. I'm not talking about moving in and I don't want to change your life. But there's a warm wind blowing the stars around and I'd really love to see you tonight.
Singing Parker McGee's I Really Want to See You Tonight. Today on the Helicaster Jane Show, the surviving member of that iconic group, Grammy-nominated John Ford Coley. But first, welcome to the Helicaster Jane Show. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. The Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HelicasterJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And while you're there, explore our ads and support the show with a click on the links. We want to welcome our new partner, our favorite store, the finest in offering gourmet foods, Dean and DeLuca. And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, SoundCloud, the iHeartRadio Network, and at our newest home on Google Play Music. Music of our lives. We hear that phrase a lot. The songs of a generation that, when listened to, transport us back in time to a special place and leave us with a smile. Let me throw out some song titles and you tell me if it isn't true. I'd Really Love to See You Tonight. Nights Are Forever Without You. Love Is the Answer. Sigh. These are the songs and numerous others that have made John Ford Coley a singing legend. The half of the Grammy-nominated duo England Dan and John Ford Coley. John has spent decades touring, writing, and recording, classically trained on piano, and an avid guitarist with double platinum and gold records behind him. John also has produced other artists, most recently Eddie Money. And from time to time, he acts too. What becomes a music legend? Let's talk. So, John, you and I have talked a lot, and of all the things about our marathon conversations, here's what fascinated me most. Not what you said or revealed, but damn, you are just about as mellow as your music. It can't be true. Are you as mellow as you seem to be?
No, it's all a facade. You kidding? I bust up chairs and things like, oh, musicians, you know we're all hot-tempered and crazy. So, no, seriously, that's just kind of the nature of... I remember one time we were on Mike Douglas' show, and he sat there for a second, and he just looked at us, and he said, you know, if there's ever a real emergency, I want you two guys around me. He says, you just don't budge. I laughed and said, yeah, I know. I've been told that I'm the one you want first on the accident scene, that's for sure.
So tell me this, what does get you riled? What's the thing that gets you absolutely crazy? Is the state of the music industry get a notch on your belt? Because, boy, we could have a whole conversation just on that. Make you crazy what's going on in the music industry today?
A lot of things that trouble me right now, and I think I've probably come to the point in my life realizing that there's not a whole lot that I can do about them. And so you just try to do what you can to make whatever's going to be best. It's like I just had a friend over here, and he was talking about the state of the music industry. It is what it is. It's not going to change. The people that are coming in, they don't have the same values or morals or you know, the eye for detail that we used to have.
John, hold on. I'm hearing a really weird noise in the background. Do you hear that?
No, I'm hearing birds chirping. That's about it.
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry, but I keep getting these kind of like weird things. I don't know what they are, if they're coming from your end or mine, and I've never heard this before. There's another one. Do you hear that?
Hey, you know what?
No, what?
You're being taped. You know, you've already mentioned the government. Hey, they might be on our trail, you know?
They would, with all the politics that I do, that wouldn't be surprised if they come after me.
I was watching a thing the other night on Red Skelton, and his middle name was Red. And so they kept saying, no, you can't have a middle name Red. So he kept having to ask his mom. So finally one day she said, just make up one. So he goes back to school and he sees a sign, Bernard's Laundry or something like that. And so when the teacher asked him his middle name, he said, well, it's Bernard. Well, it wasn't his name, but she just wasn't going to accept Red. So when he met Edgar J. Hoover, Hoover referred to him as Bernard. And he goes, where did you get that? And he says, oh, it's in your dossier. And he said, my dossier? You never know.
You don't know. Absolutely, you don't know. And I imagine, like, with who was it? Jim Morrison. You know, they had a whole dossier on him. They almost took him down, really. So music industry people, maybe I shouldn't talk to you guys. God help me, I could wind up.
You probably was.
My crazy career, I'm sure that I am. Let's go back to the music industry, and then we'll just leave all that nonsense in the background, and everybody who's listening to the show will just know how real we really are. But it is a mess. It's just an absolute mess what's coming out of that industry. So somebody like an old diehard like you, somebody with your talent, somebody who's been around as long as you have, it really does have to rile you.
Well, the thing is that, again, you just recognize that there's changes that are coming. I often think, I wonder what Frank Sinatra would have thought of the music that I did, or what he would have thought, you know, of other things. It changes. There's a lot of it that I like. There's a lot of it that I just absolutely scratch my head on. Some of the artists, you get the people that are in it, that are coming in, and they don't come in for the same reasons. They come in for the drugs or the girls or the notoriety or things of that nature. And I tell you, the best example I've ever seen, I was in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia a couple of years ago. And so there was an electronics store and it had all kinds of TVs and computers. So I'm in there, big, big screen TV. And there's a guy up on stage. He doesn't have a shirt on. He's dancing all around. He's falling on the floor. There's scantily clad women, and they are all over him. They're pawing all over him, and there's flash bulbs going off everywhere. There's got to be 10,000 people in this arena. And I sat there, and I watched that, and I thought, you know what? First of all, your song really stinks. You don't have a song. It's all entertainment. Well, then I left the shop, and I hear music, and I go downstairs, and there's a Chinese band playing down there, and they've got all these weird instruments that I'd never seen, and they were really good. And there had to be maybe 15 people watching them, and I thought, isn't that the way it goes? You get people that are really dedicated, they've got a lot of talent, and they've got 15 people, but you've got somebody that's just doing entertainment, tearing off clothes and stuff, and you've got 10,000 people and light bulbs going off everywhere.
Well, first of all, let me tell you two things. One is, I can guarantee you Frank Sinatra would love your music. Love your music. So that doesn't even go without question. And the word that you used was artist. And I think that's a term that's thrown around a lot these days. And there are musicians, and I suspect that there are entertainers and then there are artists. That's a rare combination where you get all three. You be one of them. So let's go forward. I want to go back to your childhood. I want to get this whole story about you. You were born in Texas, right? You were raised in Dallas, correct?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yes.
Talk to me about your upbringing. Good parents? I know you have a
great parents. My mom and dad both supported me. I had a good relationship with them. And so it was always one. They had a really bizarre sense of humor. I was not raised with a lot of the country music that people are raised with down there. I was raised with show tunes and opera and classical music and you know, some rock and roll, a little bit of the country, a lot of church music. But the thing is that it was so eclectic that I picked up on so many different things from it. I was always a cowboy. If you ever saw me, my pictures, I'm always in a cowboy hat and boots and spurs and guns on me. And I pretty much maintained that throughout my life because there's a closeness to the ground. So I really enjoy being around the horses and such. But it's like I came from a long line of settlers. I had a great-great-great-grandfather that actually was on his way to the Alamo to reinforce the Alamo. And they made it to Gonzales, Texas from Mina, Texas, which is Bastrop now. And there were 60 volunteers, and they made it to Gonzales 60 miles away the day before the Alamo fell. Well, he would have been killed if they had made it to the Alamo, and I wouldn't be here. But then he went on to fight at the Battle of San Jacinto that took Texas away from Mexico in April. And that was 180 years ago, a couple of days ago. And he was one of the 34 men out of about 900 that were wounded. So I think about that a lot.
You come from a long line of cowboys.
I come from that. I've got a grandfather 10 generations back that was a Jamestown.
Hmm.
So we go back a long way in the country. And I admire and I appreciate all the historical roots that the family's gone through.
I'll bet. But here's something. Yeah,
there's blood in the ground, so therefore there's an appreciation and a loyalty to it.
So here's something else that I find fascinating about you, and that is that you were classically trained, and I think that has a lot to do with this thing that's going on right now. Kids today don't quite have the upbringing in music that your generation had. And who were you playing, Mr. Piano Man? You're playing Bach, Beethoven. Who were you playing to start with?
Tchaikovsky, Liszt, all those. I mean, I love it. I still play it today. But the reason why those kids are not getting that kind of an education is the budget cuts. I remember when I lived in California and they had Prop 13. And one of the first things that they did is they took out the musical education out of the schools. So the kids don't have the eclectic kind of education that we got. We got Stephen Foster. We got West Side Story. We had all of these things coming in. Now they don't. They're just raised on rock and roll.
Right.
It's our fault. You know, it's like the other day. I mean, I look at a lot of the things going, okay, we could have done better. We can do better for our kids. They should be able to understand the world from a different perspective, but we got lazy. So there was a little girl that was talking about dating. And she said, you know, everybody now, it's not serious. Everybody just wants to hang out. And I wrote her and I said, you know what? I'm really sorry. I apologize. It's our fault. Because the thing is that we didn't raise our sons properly. So as a result, this is what you're going to get. And, you know, it's the same thing with music. If we're not raising them to understand what all these other elements are and that there are other elements that can come into your music, you're going to get the same thing. And it's trite and it's banal and it's insidiously inane. And that's what you get.
And it is what it is, which is kind of a sad story.
Well, we can do better. When you look at the music business, it's precisely that. It's a business. And people that are in it are there to make money. And most of them don't care about the music. Have you seen this thing, Vinyl, that's on HBO?
No.
Okay, it's all about the 70s music. You find out that a lot of the people that are in there, they don't care about music. They care about making a living. They care about making money. And if this one's there and it works, great. Everybody's disposable. You cease to work, we'll find somebody else. It's always the fastest gun in the West syndrome.
Yeah, and isn't that just too bad? But welcome to capitalism. That's what we're all about these days. Were you a good kid, a troublemaker, a nerd? What were you?
I have no problem with capitalism whatsoever. You know, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool capitalist. But the drawback is that we're sacrificing quality.
Right.
For the things that don't last. It's all transitory.
So true, so true, so true. So let me get back to the other. I'm going to go back to the childhood. Good kid? Bad kid? Nerd? What kind of kid were you?
Yeah, I was kind of a medium kid. You know, I played football. I didn't get into a lot of trouble. The funny thing about it is that I was raised by my aunts and uncles a lot. And so there was a great sense of honor in how you treat women, how you treat people, how you behave in public. You're going to have times where you get off, but there's a thing of respect. And so that became part and parcel of my life. As a matter of fact, we had a thing when I was in Singapore a couple of years ago. And so there was a very long line. And I was there for literally for 2.5 hours. I only played for 1 hour 45, but I was in that line for 2.5 hours. And so the promoter was kind of angry. He wanted me to finish up. And he told the other guy that I was with, he said, you know, Tabby, quit spending so much time with people. Just run them through here. And the guy looked at him and he said, that's John. He will leave when everybody else has come through the line. Leave him alone. You know, that's maybe I shouldn't do that, but it's just the way that I was raised. Treat everyone and treat them respectfully.
Okay, so talk to me about this. So here you are, this kid. Music is your life. 16 years old, you and Dan Seals first get together, correct?
Yes.
That's the only answer you're going to give me anymore?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, Dan and I went to high school together. And what happened was Dan was actually in an established band. They had a guitar player that quit. And so Dan wanted another guitar player, but everybody else wanted to try a keyboard player. So I ended up getting the audition and I got the job. And Dan and I did not get along. We were kind of like flour and water. He didn't want me in there. And so we would end up periodically having to ride to different gigs together. And we found out that we had kind of a natural blend. We'd sing, you know, and do Everly Brothers and things like that. He'd take the lead. I always took the harmony. And we kind of got to be really close friends. And they're almost kind of like brothers. So that's pretty much how that whole system got together.
So question here, when you start playing music together, did you know, forget the personality aspect of it, but just playing music together, did you know right away there was something that you guys could do that was just magic?
You know, we never intended it to go that far. I think that we were probably just using it because we enjoyed doing it, first of all. Kept me from having to work at grocery store packing groceries. And, I mean, it was an experience. It was an adventure. So we never really planned on becoming, quote, stars. We were just all trying to play music and enjoy ourselves. I mean, we were making $5 a night, you know, and then we'd go blow that on pizza. So it wasn't something that was very lucrative for us in that sense. It was a lot of fun. And it just kind of developed and took on a life of its own.
True story. You started touring at 16?
Pretty much, yeah.
And that band was, because it went through some name changes, so that band was...
We started off with Playboys 5, and it was actually still the same members, but we changed the name to These Few, and then we changed it to the South Coast FOB. We had one drummer that got drafted, and then we had another one that we added, a trumpet player, Randy Bates. And we got records going and things like that, and then Dan and I split from that group, started kind of doing more of an acoustic thing, came to Los Angeles, and things just kind of started pop.
So here's my other question, though, about that. So you did have a hit back then.
Right, Smell of Incense.
43 on the charts.
Right.
You were 16?
I was 16. At that time, I was about 18.
I mean, give me a break.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just extraordinary. And early on, you shared the billing with Led Zeppelin? I mean, right? Now, that cracks me up, because if you ask me that, sounds like a Stairway to Heaven story, yada, 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 bada, bada, bing. I mean,
At that time, we were in the band, and so we were following the trend. So we had a very heavy, heavy rock influence. I mean, we played at one time we started off with the Beach Boys, and we went to all the songs that were popular on the radio. Then when the psychedelic era came in, the 60s, you know, we jumped into that. Then we jumped into more rock. Dan and I were writing different things. And the band was doing them. So you just progress. I mean, a lot of people think that it's an overnight sensation. It wasn't. There was a lot of hard work and time and energy that went into it. So, I mean, we were constantly learning our craft. And I mean, we were learning rejection. We were learning what to say, what not to say, how to behave on the road. And even when I went on the road with a lot of these people like Brad or Elton John or, you know, so many different people, they literally took us under their wing and taught us how to behave on the road, because it's an entirely different system out there.
What does that mean, behave on the road? What does that mean?
Sorry?
What does behave on the road mean?
Well, the thing is that when you go into an airport, for example, you know, there's a certain protocol that you go through. You learn how to check into hotels. You learn how to get car rentals. You learn how to go from point A to point B. You learn to be on time. That costs us a lot, you know, because, again, you miss an airplane. Hey, guess what? You're going to miss the gig. You're going to miss the gig. You're not going to get paid. They're not going to call you back the next time. So, you know, it's behaving. It's how you learn to take care of yourself on the road.
Well, I'm going to talk to you about musicianship. Explain to me what happens when you listen to a song you love. What does John hear? What happens to John's brain, to his fingers, to his heart when he plays a song and sings a song? Can you give us a feel for that? I don't think it could possibly be the same thing for you as it would be for me.
Well, it's not, and I'm notorious for it. It's like, you know, I used to, when I would go to church, and they would have the, quote, worship music. Most of the time, I'm sitting there, I'm figuring out chords. Everybody else is doing their thing, but in my mind, I'm sitting there going, D minor, B minor, A, D minor. You know, I'm doing chords. And I'm listening to the lyrics going, oh, come on. And most of the time, I get up and I walk out because I'm bored.
Don't tell anybody.
I had a thing one time to where they wouldn't allow me to play in the band. And I thought, you know, why do I not get to play in the band? And so one day I was walking out, and I just went, man, why do I not get to play like this? And in my spirit, I heard, because first of all, you get to play all the time. They don't. And within 15 minutes of playing with those guys, you would be so bored that you'd never want to play with them again, because everything is two chords or three chords, and there's no adventure in it. So, I mean, when I listen to something, if something's got a lot of chords and it's got a beautiful melody to it or something that's very attractive, then I listen to that, I zone in on that, I'm changing chords, I'm learning the chords in the song in my head, and then I'm listening to the lyrics going, well, I wouldn't have said it that way. I would not have done it. You know what? That song I don't particularly care for anymore. Or this one just blows me away. Just like the other day, I'm so sad to hear about Prince dying. And then they said, well, you know, he wrote all these other songs. And I went, well, I wonder which ones he wrote. And Manic Monday came up. And I went, you got to be kidding me. That's one of my favorite songs. And he wrote it and I didn't know it. So, you know, music's got its own breath.
It does for people like you. There's no question about that. And I'm curious about this. When you're in the zone, when you're playing, when you're singing, when it's going really, oh my God, you know, you've got the moment, right? You've hit the chord. You know, you're right in there. You're, as I said, in the zone. What's in your head? Is it music that's in your head? Is it a place that's in your head? Are you alone? Are you with the band? What's the story?
Depends on what the song is. I mean, they bring up all different kinds of moods. I go into my head and I just kind of get internally quiet. I'm not one that jumps around up and down. I mean, it hits me in my solar plexus, and it kind of moves me. It kind of moves me backwards or forwards. It's difficult to explain. But it is an emotional feeling. I mean, I'm Irish, you know, I'm Euro trash actually. But the thing is that a lot of the Irish comes up in me, and man, I get moved. I cry at card games, you know. So the thing is I get moved on stuff.
That's sweet.
I don't mind showing you either. I mean, there's been times when I played in Asia, they would know the songs in many cases better than I would. And as a result, they would be singing the song louder than what I was singing. So when you've got your song, knowing that it's attracted, or other people have been attracted to it enough to the point that they've learned the lyrics and they're singing it back to you, I just step back. They think I'm just letting them sing. No, it's not. I'm so emotionally moved that I can't sing myself without crying or cracking up, you know, in that way.
Wow.
So I just let them go because it hits me very, very emotionally.
I want to go back to you and Dan and your sound. I read somewhere, tell me if this is true or not, that you like the Everly Brothers. That was one of the things that was influencing your sound. Who else?
The Everly Brothers. We had a lot of people, the Beach Boys. You know, I've always been attracted to people that sing harmony. So you get the Buffalo Springfield, different groups. But the Everly Brothers were one that had harmonies right on top of one another. It wasn't where you sang the harmony and it was buried. You had the lead singer and then you just had a harmony singer that was singing things that was down below that. These guys were right on top of one another. They were equal. So when Dan and I started out, that was the way that our records were mixed because, again, it was a very prominent sound with those two voices being dominant as opposed to just the one. Later on, they began to move mine further and further down from the insistence of the record company because they, again, were looking at this is the way that it should be done, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and so we're going to start moving this. And then that's when problems started.
Well, you know there's always a problem as soon as they get their two little cents in. You are listening to the Hallie Kasserjian Show. My guest today is Grammy-nominated John Ford Coley of the iconic group England Dan and John Ford Coley. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. Hi, this is Hallie Kasserjian. Are you enjoying the show? I hope so. And I hope that you'll tell your friends about it and help us grow our family. How can you help? That's easy. Share the link to the show with your friends or my show's player. And I would love it even more if you'd recommend they visit my website at HallieKasserJane.com. I look forward to seeing all of you there. And we are back on the Hallie Kasserjian Show. Thank you for being here. My guest today is Grammy-nominated John Ford Coley of the iconic group England Dan and John Ford Coley.
Here's
something else. And you went through, it was Coley and Waylon, then it became England Dan and John Ford Coley, and there's a whole thing about Dan's name and your name.
Yeah.
I love the music industry. Talk to me.
The thing is that everybody needs some kind of a name that will set you apart from everybody else. And so most of the groups are using their last name, like we've done, Coley Waylon, Seals and Crofts, or you had the Carpenters, Hall and Oates, Loggins and Messina. And so we thought, you know something, we got to have something a little bit more unique, something that's going to stand out. And we couldn't come up with it. And Jimmy Seals, actually from Seals and Crofts, who is Danny's older brother, he's the one who came up with England Dan and John Ford Coley. And Dan used to run around years before mimicking the English accent. Now, if you've ever heard anybody from Texas try to imitate anything other than a Texan southern accent, it ain't pretty. So Dan would try to do this. So we just kind of came up with the name England Dan. And then I was working rodeo. I'm an old cowboy. And I was working rodeo at that time. And Jimmy thought that it would sound better if we dropped the L. So it had Coley, John Coley. And then there was a Confederate general named John Rip Ford. And he won the last battle of the War for Southern Independence down in Texas. And he was also one of the people that had buried many of the men in the Alamo. Well, that just kind of came up naturally, John Ford Coley. And then you've got the association with John Ford, the director. And it seemed to be something that people would catch on to. And he was right. So bingo, we just ended up with that.
But here's my question. Piano player, that's how you were trained. You turned to guitar, right?
Uh-huh.
Singer. Unbelievable singer. What comes first? Which is the more important to you? Which is the one, if you had to choose one, that you go with?
No, that's really an unfair question. That's kind of like, who do you like best, your mommy or your daddy? You know, it depends. I mean, there are times that like right now, for example, I've kind of put the piano back just a little bit because I'm not on a learning curve, but on a guitar, I'm on a learning curve. So that's normally what I will grab right now. But that's subject to change. I mean, I sit down and I play piano almost every day as well. But I'm not getting the new things. So I'll just wait till something new comes up.
Wow.
But I love playing all of them. I love different instruments for different reasons. because again, with piano, I can throw in thirds and fifths and ninths and things of that nature. But with guitar, I'm not that proficient on it. So I just.
I don't know. You sound pretty proficient to me, buddy. Listen, so Herb Albert hears you. He was hesitant to sign you guys. Is that correct?
He was, yes.
But he did. Were you over the moon, A&M? Oh, my God.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because A&M was a big thing. And then Herb Albert was also a very big artist at that time. And from what I was looking at, he was one of the last musicians that was actually running the company. So you knew that there was going to be something in him that he would hear that other people would not. And Herb was a great guy. I loved working for Herb. I just remember the first time that we went in to show our looking at the album jacket on the first record. He said, this is what we're looking for. And I said, well, I don't like this one, Dance. Well, I don't like that. And he looked at us and he says, guys, he said, it doesn't matter, really. He says, what this album jacket looks like. He says, we don't expect anything off this record. He said, we don't really expect anything off the next one. The third one, we expect to have some hits off of. And I thought, whoa. Now, we went back 10 years later. I mean, or when I went back with the girls, and the attitude was, yep, you get one shot. If it didn't make it, you're out of here. So, I mean, when I would see how he would build things, he truly was an inspiration. I've had some wonderful mentors in this business, and Herb Albert definitely was one of them.
You had an interesting career thing because you had a hit early on, right?
Yeah, we got lucky with a thing called Simone. It actually was number one in Japan and in France. And so we got to tour Japan with Three Dog Night. It was a remarkable time, you know, because, again, we're being exposed to the world. I mean, I'm a little Texas boy. I never thought I was going to really get out of Dallas. And I thought I'd be back there doing construction or working in law or something. I mean, punching cattle. No. It was great to be able to go out and actually see that the world existed. And that lit my bug even more because when I went to school, I was an English literature student. So I'm reading all the time. So to be able to go to these places and actually see where all these events that I had read about during my years, I mean, that was absolutely a staggering step for me.
Here's the thing, though. So it didn't last. What goes up must come down. A&M drops you. And you went through a pretty scary, almost two-year dry spell at that point before you got signed again with Big Tree Records, a subsidiary of Atlantic Records. And that's when I Really Want to See You Tonight, written by the great Parker McGee, comes to you, right?
Right.
And he also wrote, by the way, Nights and Forever. Wow. First time you heard the song? What?
No, actually, we thought it was more of a girl song. We didn't hear it at all. Seriously.
I believe you.
They sat there and said, no, we would like you to try this because we think that it can be done. And so we ended up having Louise Shelton, who was part of the Wrecking Crew. He actually ended up producing our first couple records, and then he produced Seals and Crofts. And he pulled in a couple of people that we knew, David Page and Jeff Picaro, who ended up being in Toto. And we all kind of put this thing together, and it kind of took off. I mean, we were as stunned as anybody else. And so the funny thing about it was that Dan and I were known for writing our own songs. And I think I'd made probably at least $1.98 over the years on the songs that I had written. So we didn't want to do anybody else's songs. You know, we're eventually going to break through here. Well, we got the first royalty check on that song. And I'm looking at Parker going, hey, Parker, what else you got, man? Anybody else? Just throw them up here. So we kind of changed our attitude about taking on other people's songs to record.
And you did it so beautifully. I mean, I think that the song, truly just extraordinary. Here's another part, place I wanted to go with you. This question of writing, because you do write music.
All the time, yes.
Right. So does that come easy to you? And what, does your ego step aside when a situation comes up where they offer you this great Parker song and you say, okay, I'm going to do it?
I tell you what, there are so many different ways that songs come. I mean, I write all the time. For me, it's a labor of love that I hate because what happens is that you always want to push it to the nth degree, and sometimes it just won't go there. There's one song on this new CD that took me, I started it in 2007, And no, actually, I started in I'm sorry, I take that back. It was in 1997 I started this song. It wouldn't come. I tried to write it with other people. Wouldn't come. I'd put it away, pull it out, put it away, pull it out. Finally, about a year and a half ago, I just happened to be reading in the Bible, in Deuteronomy. And so I hit the part where it said, I set before you today blessing and cursing, life and death. Choose life. Bingo, I went, that's it. That's life. It vomited itself out from that point on. Literally just came out. There was nothing that I could do to stop it. There are other times that you work really hard trying to get the song down. Sometimes it comes really easy. There's one, the guy's yelling at me on this new CD because there was one called Wild Horses that I wrote. It was the last one that's going on this CD. And he said, how did that come to you? And I said, look, that's not even my style. Okay, I can tell you right now, it's got my name on it, but I have no idea who wrote that song. And there are times that divine inspiration takes over and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that that happens to. Soldier in the Rain is a perfect example of that.
You're so lucky.
Well, the thing is that you just kind of feel kissed by God on certain things. You know, you recognize it, you're not that smart and you're not that clever and you're not that brilliant, no matter how much you tell yourself you are. There's external circumstances that come in and they take over. And you sometimes just have to step out of the way. And if you'll step out of the way, it'll come. But if you keep trying to direct it and dominate it, you're eventually going to get it maybe, but it could have come a lot easier.
So listen to me. This is interesting to me also. You are hit after hit after hit. It's bizarre. So few people get that many hits in a row and that kind of accolade. Okay, that's great. But talk to me about this. John, personal life. Was there one?
Oh, yeah, there's always a personal life. I'm selfish enough to take time for myself. Now, when the career was going and it was really going big, I stepped back and I recognized again that it's the old fastest gun in the West syndrome. So there's always over your shoulder that you're having to look back on because somebody's going to try to take your place. So when I would come off the road, I was constantly writing. I was constantly moving in that direction. But I also took time for me because I recognize you can get burnout. And when you get that burnout, and fortunately enough, I had seen it on many of the guys that I had worked with. So when you see that coming, you step back just for simple self-preservation.
So you did meet a woman.
Yes.
In fact, you married her.
In fact,
you've been married 37 years.
About 30 years.
Four kids?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Grandkids?
I got four grandchildren.
So is she the better half?
She's definitely the smarter half, that's for sure.
Oh, what's it? I'd love to get her on the air. What's it like living with John Ford Cully, brilliant musician that you are?
You know, the funny thing about it is that because you got to understand the philosophy that I've always had with music is the one that Bob Geldof had. And that's if you take music for anything or rock and roll for anything other than a joke, you're a blithering idiot. It's a means to do something. It's something that's inside of you. It doesn't define who I am. I mean, I go off and I do things that you probably would think, well, that's not in keeping with the glamorous lifestyle. You know, I've done that. I've seen that. It's not that entertaining. So I'd rather go out and I'd rather work with horses.
You and I have that in common, by the way. Did you know that?
So you know what that is.
I know what that is. There's nothing like it.
Because, again, a lot of people want to know. I mean, for me, when I get around these other musicians and they want to talk about music all the time, man, it's the most boring thing in the world. And I'd rather talk about alternative medicine or books or films or you know, things that I'm going to value and learn something from. Who did what, when they did it, how they did it. Yeah, okay.
But here's my question. Is that you now? Is that the 60-some-odd-year-old man who's been through it all, seen it all, done it all, able to say that? Do you think that the young man of 16 or 17 or 21 could have said that?
No, I think that at 16 and 17, you know, you've got your focus and how you're going to do things. And that's absolutely wonderful because we all did. But even at that point, you're going to discover, I mean, I love it when these young kids get out on the road and they've seen the glamour, they see how everybody lives, all the things that go on, how, what you become. You've got people pawing at you all the time. And you know what? You still go to that hotel room by yourself when you get out there. There's still nothing for you to do 23 hours out of the day except eat and sleep and work on your computer and play your guitar. You go from point A to point B, and you're bored most of the time. I mean, most of the people, it's so funny, they say, when they don't know me, they go, so what do you do? And I go, I'm a baggage handler. I carry bags. And they go, what? You work at a hotel? I go, pretty much. That's what I do. I mean, I carry bags from point A to point B. I pack and unpack bags most of the time. It's a great life. I love it. I know how to do it. I can function better out on the road than I can function at home. I mean, you know, at least you can get room service at a hotel. But it's, you know, it's just, if you're 16 years old and you think this is all it is, okay, it is. It's got definitely great elements, and I loved it and cherish every experience I had. I've had a hell of a ride. But you know what? Dig a little deeper. You're going to find that there's a lot more out there. When you go into these towns and you're hanging out, you know, and you're hanging out in the bar, hey, you know what? Probably down the street, you're going to find out what Boston Massacre was. Go down there. Look at it. See it. Put your hands on the stones. You know, to me, that's what turns me on.
Fascinating. Here's this, too. You have toured with, worked with some of the most iconic names in the business. Elton John, who you toured England with for a month, Fleetwood Mac, Chicago, Carole King, Brad Loggins and Messina, you mentioned a few, Carly Simon, Steve Miller Band, one of my favorites, Jesse Colin Young, who I represented 1,000 years ago, talk to you about that off air one day. Best memory. Pick one.
Elton John took us to England with him for a month. We actually got Van Hicks and the Hot Licks had to cancel out because they were on the Johnny Carson show. So they needed somebody to take their place, and they put Dan and I in there. So we played 2 gigs with him. We got along really well with him and all the people. Played one more gig with him down in San Diego, and the next thing we know, we're getting a call from him to tour England with him for a month. So here I am in England for a month, you know, with this whole thing, getting the exposure that we got. I mean, I just so cherish those days of being able to go out with all these people. Bread was another one. The guys in Bread. I mean, how we ended up with them, we played a couple of shows with them, and then one day our manager gets a call from the agent, and he says, what did Dan and John say to David Gates? And she goes, okay, look, it probably wasn't Dan. It was probably John. You know, he's kind of loose cannon here. I was at that time. And she said, what happened? And he says, well, David Gates called me this morning and said, do not book us unless you book England and John Ford Coley with us. Wow. And so we toured with these guys for all those years. We're on their greatest hits album. Getting to play with Seals and Crofts, you know, all those years and record with them, or being guests on different people's records or stuff, meeting some of my favorite icons and finding out that they're real people.
Ah, yeah, just like you are.
Well, the thing is that, again, I go back to it, it's like anybody that takes this industry for anything other than a joke is a blithering idiot. It's people. If you're not a nice person, nobody's going to want to work with you. If you're a nice guy, everybody's going to want to work with you. I've got some great memories of some of the best people, but the ones that treated us badly, I remember those too.
Oh, tell me one. Tell me one. Give me one.
Tell you one.
One who treated you guys badly.
Mickey Mantle.
Who?
Mickey Mantle. Just.
I didn't hear you. Say it again.
Mickey Mantle.
Mickey Mantle. I grew up with him in my house.
Yeah, well,
go tell me, talk to me, tell me the story.
I was doing a thing on Dinosaur Show, and Billy Crystal was, you know, literally licking Mickey's ear. He was so excited to be with him. And then I sat there and I asked Mickey a question, and he turned around and he looked at me and he went, "Yeah," and he turned back away. And I thought, "Whoa, what was that?" And so then Billy's again going off on his thing, and I asked him another question. He turned around and he did the same thing. And I thought, wait a minute, what's going on here? So I asked him something else. And he turned around and he said, what do you want? And I went, nothing, man, nothing at all. And we're guests on the show together. And that just completely blew me away.
Was that his drinking age?
I have no idea. And you know something? I don't care.
Wow.
I really don't care. You just don't treat people that way.
I mean, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. So let's go here. Okay? Inevitable question, my friend. Okay. So why did you guys break up? And where did the breakup leave you? And was it hard to go on? Listen to me of the last part of that question. Or was it important that you move on?
I think it's always important that you move on, because if you're stagnant, you're not going to progress at all. And so there's always something better. And I've gotten to the point in my life where I don't believe in coincidence and nickels worth. There is a reason for everything happening. And the official story is that Dan and I were moving in different directions, which is actually true. We were. But the unofficial thing is that like every other group that comes along, you have people that begin to divide you. They come in and it becomes insidious. And so they start saying, you know, you're the one that does this. He's not really doing this. You're the guy. And so you get that on both sides. And then the sad part about it is not the fact that they do it. It's the fact that you believe it. And when you believe it, then it's over. So Dan and I ended up, you know, we fell victim to that same insidious behavior that so many other people come into. And for the longest time, Dan and I didn't talk. We weren't friends. And then one day we just both said pretty much at the same time, you know, we grew up together, man. We were like brothers. This is stupid. This is ridiculous. And so we were able to patch the relationship up. We just didn't play together any longer because he'd gone off in the country and I went off into music and film. But, I mean, you got to move on. And I mean, long, long time ago, I don't fight battles from you know, 40 years ago in the shower. It's like, it's done, it's over, we move on. And when Dan passed away, he and I talked the day before he passed away, and it was like we were, you know, 35 years ago. I have no regrets. I have nothing that was left unsaid. I think of Dan fondly. I remember him every time that I play and make mention of him. Because, again, without him, neither one of us probably would have gone anywhere.
Losing him, how horrible was that for you?
Well, it was a shock. I mean, because first of all, I don't know if you ever knew Dan. Dan probably was one of the most genuine, funny guys you would ever meet in your life. He was just always very, very funny. And the things that he would say were unusual and unique. He was a great songwriter. He was a great friend. Dan was a very wise man. And I enjoyed the wisdom. I enjoy wisdom that comes from anyone. And Dan had that old soul wisdom to him. And so when he said something, or when we would discuss things, it wasn't somebody that you just blew off. You listened to him. And I really appreciate that. And I was so sad when he left, simply because not only was my friendship affected, although it wasn't the friendship that we had had previously, it had a lot of memories attached to it, but the fact that Dan was still very prolific and still out playing and still writing songs and recording, you know, you feel a thievery in that way, that the world has been robbed of somebody bringing more to them that would be to their benefit.
Last question. Let's take it here. You and I, as I said, talked off air. We share a lot of things in common. Your spiritual life. I know this has been a huge journey for you, John. You have gone, you were Baha'i at one point. I think you were raised Southern Baptist.
Right.
You've gone through the whole song and dance. Talk to me about that.
Oh, I love the teaching. I study all the time. I just absolutely love reading the Bible, getting into spiritual conversations, learning and knowing, because there's so many things that we've been taught that are inaccurate. And as a result, it's caused a lot of friction. Well, a good portion of my life seems like it's been to kind of undo a lot of the things that we have been taught that we're nowhere close to true. The problem is that nobody wants to hear it. So you just kind of dig deeper all the time and try to grow and learn. When I talk about the Bible, I'm not there to try to prove points, because there are people that will take that book and beat the poop out of you with it. You just simply because it's control. I use it for one thing. That's to transform my life. That's it. I'm not interested in winning theological debates or arguments or how many angels can sit on the head of a needle and dance. You know, I don't care. It's just, it's a matter of what is it going to do? How is it affecting me? What's it caused me to do to other people? How does it affect my music? How does it affect my everyday living, my children, all of these different things? How do I behave? Because I really, truthfully, I don't care what you preach, teach, or try to attempt to shove down my throat. I'm going to watch how you behave. That's all I need to know as to whether I'm going to be interested in listening to anything that you've got to preach or teach.
You did say you had no regrets, but this is one last question. If I had to do it to do over again, I would.
Oh man, that's a question that requires some thought. I probably, if I had it to do over again, because of being in the religion that we were in, being hooked with seals and crofts, we were kind of inclusive with everyone. What I would do is I would go out and I would work with a whole lot more people on an individual basis, as opposed to just staying stuck in one little atmosphere. Because again, there's so many people that I work with now that I've had so much fun, because again, you're gathering new information. It's like when I was, I'll give you a perfect example. When I was on the road traveling in the band, you've got the people that come in, it's the same people all the time. So as a result, after the first couple of days, the jokes are gone, all the stories are gone that they've been home. There's nothing new to discuss. There's nothing that anybody's bringing in. Now, as an actor, when I was an actor, you had day players. So you had people constantly coming in. They're bringing in new jokes. They're bringing in new stories, new information. Did you hear about this? Da-da-da-da-da. It was such a wonderful time for me because I thrive on information. I like to know because I like to know. I'm just kind of an epistemologist in that way. I just want to know so that I'm not fooled. And that's pretty much, you can sum that up for me now. That if I had it to do again, I would be gathering in a lot more people, a lot more information, networking a lot more, and just learning different ways as opposed to being stuck in one particular group.
You know, buddy, you prove one thing. Ready? Love
yeah.
is the answer.
Yeah, love is the answer.
I've been speaking with John Ford Coley, formerly of England Dan and John Ford Coley. For more information on John, for more about when and where he will be performing, to discover more about his book that chronicles his amazing career, Backstage Pass, and to learn more about his new CD project, Eclectic, visit John's website at johnfordcoley.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to the LA Cancer Jane Show, a production of Resac LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit LACancerJane.com.